1,512 crew members were aboard the USS Arizona during the attack on Pearl Harbor. 1,512. By the end of the day, 1,177 of those men were dead. 1,177. That's 78% of a single ship's crew, accounting for 49% of the total loss of life at Pearl Harbor. So on that Sunday afternoon, as news of the attack began to spread across U.S. airwaves, thousands of USS Arizona families gathered together in their homes, crowded into their living rooms. Radios tuned in with the hopes of hearing word that their loved one had been spared. For 38 of those families, however, their fears were made double. I'm Corey Constable, and this is Omitted. On November 22, 1941, Fireman First Class Wesley John Height wrote home to his mother, Genevieve Dunlap. "Hello, Mom. This is your bad son again. Boy, have I been catching hell for not writing. I don't know why you worry about us so much. If anything happened to us, you would hear from the Navy first thing. I am safer on this battle boat than I would be driving back and forth to work if I was home." 2 days later, his brother, Fireman First Class Edward Joseph Height, deposited a letter into the same outgoing mailbox. It was addressed to a woman named Julia. "Tell Norman that I said hello, and I will come over to see him if this pig iron son of a bitch ever gets back to the States again. Please don't wait to write as long as I did." The brothers were natives of Los Angeles, California. On September 13, 1939, when they were 22 and 23 years old, they enlisted together in the Navy. 2 months later, Edward received his orders to board the USS Arizona in San Diego, and 6 months after that, Wesley followed in his footsteps. The men served the entirety of their terms on the USS Arizona, mostly docked at Pearl Harbor as a deterrent to any Japanese aggression, but briefly they accompanied the ship to the Puget Sound where she was outfitted with a slew of new weaponry. I wish I had more information about these men. I wish there was more I could tell you about their character or their sense of humor, or even just their location or whereabouts on the day their ship was attacked. All I really have is what I've told you. The military's archived information about the men, and the two letters they sent. There is no recorded information today about the experiences they specifically had, nor is there any recorded information about the experiences of Genevieve Dunlap in the weeks following the attack. She had surely heard the news, just the same as everybody else. But what she felt, and what she wondered, none of us can ever be sure. I'd imagine she probably read Wesley's words over and over again. If anything happens to us, you would hear from the Navy first thing. She didn't hear first thing, though. Like so many other mothers, she waited and she waited, and on December 21st, 2 weeks after the attack, she received a telegram in the mail. "The Navy deeply regrets to inform you that your sons Wesley John Height, Fireman First Class U.S. Navy, and Edward Joseph Height, Fireman First Class U.S. Navy, are missing following action in the performance of their duty in the service of their country. Stop. The department appreciates your great anxiety and will furnish you further information promptly when received. Stop. To prevent possible aid to our enemies, please do not divulge the name of their ship or station. Full stop." The next letter came on January 24th. "After exhaustive search, it has been found impossible to locate your sons, and they have therefore been officially declared to have lost their life in the service of their country as of December 7th, 1941. The department expresses to you its sincerest sympathy." Genevieve Dunlap died in Ventura, California in 1987. 46 years after losing both of her sons. John and Delbert Anderson were both 19 years old when they enlisted in the United States Navy. Born in Verona, North Dakota in 1917, they were the twin boys of Edwin and Laura Anderson. The 1930 census shows them living in Dilworth, Minnesota, But within a decade, they would leave their Midwestern homes together to set out on what would be the adventure of their lifetimes. Delbert, who went by his middle name Jake, was assigned to the Arizona in 1937, while John was sent to work on the USS Ellet. During his time on the Ellet, he and Jake wrote letters to each other, and Jake hoped that his brother would someday be able to join him at Pearl Harbor. On December 6, 1940, 1 year and 1 day prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor, Jake's wish was granted, and the brothers were reunited for the first time in years. On the morning of December 7th, John was setting up for church on the ship's fantail before heading to breakfast. As he stepped into the mess hall for a bite to eat, the Japanese bombs began to fall. He hurried to his station at number 4 turret, but quickly realized that there was little anyone could do to stop the bombardment. He begged his turret commander to let him join his brother at an anti-aircraft gun, and the commander agreed to let him go. As John climbed the ladder that led to his brother's battle station, a bomb struck the powder magazine of the ship, setting off an explosion that killed nearly 1,000 men instantly. "People were blown all over the place," he said. "All kinds of body parts and tremendous fires broke out." He was ordered off of the ship as it began to sink down into the harbor, but stayed behind to help load wounded sailors onto a rescue boat. "My brother's here someplace. I've got to find him," he told an officer. "He could have made it," was the officer's reply as he shoved John into the rescue boat. After reaching Ford Island, John spotted an empty boat and swam out to it. He would return to find his brother, and no officer could stop him. After reaching the ship, he pulled 3 men into his boat and searched frantically for his brother, calling out his name, screaming at the top of his lungs through the explosions and the cries for help. But it was no use. Jake was nowhere to be found. John made his way again for Ford Island, but by the time his boat had reached it, they were hit, and all of its occupants but John were killed. He swam for the island and collapsed onto its shore. John was assigned to the USS McDonough later that day. He went on to fight his way across the Pacific, waiting for word that his brother had been found. He heard later on that someone had seen Jake at his station, killed by enemy gunfire, before the explosion had even taken place. His body was never recovered. John stayed with the Navy until he retired in 1976 when he was 59 years old, at which point he went on to become a TV weatherman in Roswell, New Mexico. He died in Roswell in 2015 at the age of 98. His ashes were interred in the number 4 turret during the 75th anniversary memorial this past December. After 75 years apart, the brothers were reunited on the USS Arizona once again. Thomas Augusta Free was born on February 2, 1891 in Union Springs, Alabama. By his 20s, he had found his way to Brazos County, Texas, where he married a woman named Beatrice Allen Anderson. Thomas joined the Navy the following year, on December 22, 1917. His marriage to Beatrice was dissolved within just a few years, and at the age of 28, he married a girl named Myrtle Bice, who was 13 years his junior. I can't imagine what Myrtle's circumstances must have been. I know it was more common in those days for young girls to marry older men, but the situation seems all the more odd when coupled with the fact that this marriage would mean uprooting her life and moving away from home. Regardless, the couple remained together, and in 1924, while they were living in Portsmouth, Virginia, Myrtle gave birth to a son named William Thomas Free. Myrtle eventually resettled in Navasota, Texas, to raise William and his younger sister, Marie, while Thomas continued to live a nomadic Navy lifestyle that eventually saw him in San Diego in October of 1941, walking up the gangway onto the USS Arizona, where 17-year-old William was eagerly awaiting his father's arrival. William had known from an early age that he would follow in his father's footsteps by joining the Navy. With his parents' permission, he had enlisted in San Diego in December of 1940, and boarded the Arizona on April 27, 1941. The father and son duo served alongside each other on the ship, Thomas as a machinist mate first class, and William as a seaman second class. This is another one of those stories where I wish I had more information. At least a letter to read to you, or some sort of eyewitness account about their actions on December 7th. I don't, though. I have next to nothing. In the chaos and confusion of the day, these two men, this man and this child, were lost completely. I can only speculate that Myrtle Bice Free must have received telegrams similar to those that were sent to Genevieve Dunlap. A telegram that regretted to inform her that her husband and her only son were missing, and another a month later letting her know that they were presumed dead. Thomas and William Free were the only father-son pair aboard the USS Arizona on the day it was attacked. Their bodies were never recovered. Prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor, it was common for family members to serve alongside each other on battleships. No one really thought anything of it. But after the loss of 23 sets of brothers on the USS Arizona alone, the military began to change its approach. While no formal regulations were established, officials began to discourage brothers from fighting alongside each other. No mother, they thought, should ever have to go through the hardship of losing two sons at once. By the end of the war, however, hundreds of mothers would experience the pain that Genevieve and Myrtle had felt. A loss that's compounded, felt twice as hard, cuts twice as deep. But for Thomas and Alita Sullivan of Waterloo, Iowa, the pain was even greater. You see, their sons, feeling it was their duty to avenge the Pearl Harbor death of their friend Bill Ball, enlisted in the Navy on January 3, 1942. Their only stipulation was that they be allowed to serve together. They were taken aboard the USS Juno later that year, and found themselves on the ship when it was torpedoed by a Japanese submarine during the November 13th Naval Battle of Guadalcanal. In an effort to prevent the enemy from knowing which ships were still afloat and which had been lost, word was not immediately given to the families of the attack's victims. But when the letters from her son stopped arriving, Alita Sullivan wrote to the Bureau of Naval Personnel to ask for the truth. On January 12, 1943, a trio of uniformed naval personnel arrived on the doorstep of their family home in Waterloo. "I have some news for you about your boys," the officer said. "Which one?" asked Thomas. "I'm sorry," the officer replied. "All five." Omitted is written and produced by me, Corey Constable. Special thanks to the Delaware County District Library for providing the space and the resources to create this show. Be sure to follow along on Instagram and Twitter, or like us on Facebook. Just search for Omitted Podcast. That's OMITTED Podcast.